You are in the ring with Hector Colon, 7-time national boxing champion turned nonprofit president and CEO. Hector knocks out the big issues facing social services today with high-impact leaders from around the U.S. In the Ring is a creation of Lutheran Social Services of Wisconsin and Upper Michigan and produced by No Studios. And now, here's Hector Colon.
Hello, 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 and welcome to In the Ring with Hector Colon, the podcast that knocks out the challenges facing the social services sector and the people we serve. I am your host, Hector Colon. In the ring with me today is my friend, Sam Sipes, the president and CEO of Lutheran Services of Florida, or LSF. Welcome to the show, champ.
Thanks, Hector. I never thought I'd try to go in the ring with Hector Colon, so please be gentle with me, champ.
You're going to do just fine, so I'm really looking forward to it. I want to tell you all a little bit about Sam. Sam joined LSF as the CEO in September of 2007. At the time, LSS had several hundred employees and an annual budget of approximately $30 million. During his tenure, Sam led the organization's tremendous growth to more than 2,500 employees and a budget of more than $400 million. So we want to get into that a little bit. Very impressive. Prior to joining LSF, Sam served as the president and chief operating officer for Lutheran Services of the South in Austin, Texas. Under his leadership, the organization became the largest provider of children's residential services in Texas. Sam also was instrumental in expanding residential and non-residential services to senior citizens, along with the disaster response efforts across Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. In 2005, Sam was among the key leaders that helped organize and manage the regional and national response to Hurricane Katrina. Sam has served on numerous boards, including the Council of Accreditation for Child and Family Services, the Florida Coalition for Children and Lutheran Services in America, and he was a member of the Florida-based and community-based advisory council to identify ways to deliver services more effectively. Sam received both his Master's of Science in Social Work and Bachelor of Social Work from the University of Texas at Austin. Are you ready for round one, champ?
I think I am. I'm going to try.
All right. Let's go, champ. I know a little bit about your background. Hopefully you'll get into that with this first question, but how did you develop the passion for becoming the leader you are in social services?
Well, I'm one of those lucky people who discovered their calling rather early in life. Mm-hmm. So when I was 22 years old, I got a job working in a psychiatric hospital mm-hmm. as a mental health worker, fell in love with it, saw people that were doing jobs that I was also interested in, like therapists and unit directors and things like that. So I kind of found that very early on, loved it, and just continued to do it. I think some of my passion, though, comes from my background as well. I grew up in a rather challenging family situation. My parents did the best they could, but there were some issues. I was kind of a troubled youth myself. I dropped out of high school at the age of 16 and tried to go out and make it in the world, and kind of did at a very young age. So I think that was part of it too. It's sort of a way of giving back. And then finally, the connection with my faith. Mm-hmm. I really believe in Matthew 25, the quote that says that as you do unto the least of these, you do unto me. So I think that the services that we provide to people in need, in a way, is a sacramental act. It's almost a way of, as you're reaching out to help that person, if you look into their eyes, you have a chance to see into the eyes of God, I think. So those are kind of the areas that are the things that fuel my passion.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that, Sam, and your vulnerability for sharing a little bit about your past and how that has inspired you to do all the great work you do. You are a person with lived experience. You're a person that, had some challenges in life. And it's very inspiring to see how you want to use that to bring good to others. And certainly your faith shines and it is very clear that that inspires you as well. So thank you for sharing that. Could you tell us a little bit about your organization? What is the vision, the purpose, and what are you trying to accomplish?
So our mission is to provide healing, hope, and help to people in need in the name of Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. A very timeless mission, if you think about it. And our vision is we envision a world where kids are safe, families are strong, and communities are vibrant. And if you look at all the different things that we do, they fit into one of those three boxes that either they're dealing with keeping kids safe or family, making families stronger or contributing to the vibrancy of communities. Keeping in mind, you know, safe children, strong families, vibrant communities. We've brought on a number of programs that either deal with children who are in unsafe situations, like the child welfare system. We do foster care. We do adoption. We have runaway youth shelters for kids who are in crisis. We do a lot of outpatient and sort of street counseling with kids, at-risk kids. And then we do a lot of prevention programs. We're the largest non-governmental provider of Head Start services in the southeastern United States. Every day, we've got about 6,000 kids from at-risk families participating in our very high-quality early learning programs, you know, with bachelor's degree teachers and evidence-based curriculum to make sure that those kids, when they start kindergarten, are ready for school in an effort to really break a generational cycles of poverty. Other services that we provide on the prevention end are the runaway youth shelters that I mentioned earlier, and we work with a lot of families that are in need and at risk of having state intervention. It hasn't quite come to that yet, but it's about to. And then we have walk-in centers, family resource centers in disadvantaged communities where individuals can walk in and access any number of services from any number of agencies and get referrals to get the services that they need.
Yeah, thank you for all you do, Sam. I know, like oftentimes we say here at LSS, we serve individuals who have incredible odds stacked up against them and really try to help empower them to reach their best lives. And I know that's part of your purpose as well. You serve so many people, and I know that you make a dramatic impact on their lives. How do you collect that data and ensure that you are making a difference in their lives? And what are some of your quality outcomes relating to the people you serve?
So Florida is a little unique in terms of other states in that we privatized virtually all social services over two decades ago. Mm-hmm. So that took the state out of the position of delivering services directly, which frankly, in my opinion, having worked in a number of states, the state isn't very good at that. They're not good at being a surrogate parent or, you know, taking care of people that are in need, you know, from kind of a human perspective. And instead it put the state in the position of being able to regulate and set standards and hold accountable nonprofit agencies. So the data that is collected on the work that we do, we're continuously compared to other providers on a monthly basis. So, for example, depending on the program, if it's one of our diversion programs, we're looking at recidivism. You know, has the person come back into the system? Has the family been successfully reunited if there was a separation? You know, is somebody in counseling if they needed counseling or substance abuse treatment if they needed that? So those are the kinds of things that we're monitored by the state on a monthly basis. And then they publish scales. They rank all the providers. So, you know, how did you do this month compared to other providers? And so I think it's a pretty good system that keeps us all on our toes. There's a lot of data. We all know where we stand in comparison to the other providers. And there's, you know, there's something to strive for. If somebody else is doing things better than you are, find out what they're doing and then do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like that. Thanks for sharing that. I think other states could follow suit and be a little bit more transparent about what the requirements are, what are the outcomes you're looking for, and then being transparent of sharing that. I would say we're probably a little bit behind Florida as a state with regards to that. But thank you for sharing, because we at LSS, we want to be held accountable. We want to make sure that we're making a difference in the lives of the people we serve. And And we would love to be paid for value. The better we do, the more we get paid. Unfortunately, we're not there yet, but maybe eventually we could get there.
I have to be honest with you, Hector. We're not getting paid for value, unfortunately. Yeah. Most of our contracts are cost reimbursed. But yes, it allows us to focus on the right things, though. And in the cost reimbursed world, that one advantage is that we are able to invest more in infrastructure. We can't keep money we don't spend, but there's no incentive for us not to do the things that we can do to help make people's jobs more effective and easier.
That's great. And by us just having this conversation and talking about value, maybe we can inspire other governments, other healthcare providers to move in this space so that, again, good organizations like ours that we know we want to do a good job, we want to produce a good outcome, move more towards that value-based approach is something I know we share in common. All right. That is the end of round one, Sam. How are you feeling so far?
I don't know. I think I'm okay, but I'm ready to go back here.
Yeah, you're looking good. You're not sweating. You look like you can take some more punches, so let's go.
All right.
In round two, Sam and I will talk about the significant return on investment he and LSF experienced last year with the state of Florida. We will also find out how, in these turbulent economic times, he was able to realize a multi-million dollar cost savings in 2023. But first, a word from our sponsor.
Supporting your employees is more than a paycheck and 401k. It's just a fact. People today are at a higher risk of experiencing mental illness, housing insecurity, and substance abuse. Do you know the health of your employees, your communities? How can you step up your benefits to better address their well-being? M3 Insurance helps businesses see beyond basic benefits and support employees where they live. It's a meet them where they are approach that LSS delivers to their clients every day. M3 and LSS offer real solutions to now commonplace realities that strengthen employees and inspire communities to thrive. Test your employee benefit strategy now by going to m3ins.com.
Okay, Sam, you ready to get back in the ring for round two?
Yes, sir.
Let's go, champ. The Florida Network for Youth and Family Services reported 91.9 ROI for every dollar the states invest in nonprofit organizations that are serving children and families in need. I understand that the state of Florida saw nearly $410 million cost savings in 2023. Sam, I know that your organization was one of 27 nonprofits that are a part of this network of youth and family services mentioned in that research above. So I want to ask you, how did your organization contribute to increasing the state's bottom line through these programs?
Well, so we're the largest partner agency with the Florida Network. So that's the nonprofit partner that we have that receives funding from the Florida Department of Juvenile Justice for diversion programs. So the Florida Network is all about diversion from the juvenile justice system. We operate community-based programs and shelters in Miami, in Fort Lauderdale, in Fort Myers, and in Pensacola, in the Panhandle area of Florida. So we've got a fairly large footprint. So a lot of the work that is done by the network is done by us in our programs. And in terms of the diversion, the idea being obviously that if you can catch a family and a child who's maybe been engaged in some truancies or statutory offenses or maybe petty crime or runaway issues, catch them early, work with them and their family, and bring in the needed community supports, we can avoid the need for costly out-of-home placement in the juvenile justice system or sometimes in the child welfare system, because quite frankly, there's overlap somewhat between the two populations of kids and families. So it's a very active prevention program where we're engaging with kids in the community. Parents may bring their children by or contact us if they're having difficulty, disciplining their children. We work with kids who are considered by their parents to be, unmanageable in some cases, with the goal of being to safely reunite that child with their family and bring in the supports that's needed to keep the family from breaking down and the child from being adjudicated in the juvenile justice system. So that's basically how the program works. And that investment has paid off in terms of less need for the more costly residential beds, just more of a focus on community-based, less expensive and more effective community-based interventions.
I think that's great. You know, I know that I've said in the past that, you know, about a decade ago, we used to damage kids by placing them in residential facilities, low-level risk kids in residential facilities with high risk. And, it didn't serve them well. And so what you are doing, serving these individuals in the community with robust support services to help them reach their full potential, is so necessary and so important. And as at LSS, we have some programs relating to that as well. I want to talk a little bit about prevention, like going even deeper, early intervention. We're going to go into that in another question. But first, has the ROI that you have been able to achieve as a state translated into new or expanded funding for you?
It's hard to draw a direct line between that because we don't get to tell the state how they spend the money that they save as a result of the programs. But we have received additional funding, so we get funding occasionally if we need it for repairs to buildings that we might have, like shelters, et cetera. That's not as common, but that happens on occasion. And we got a fairly hefty increase last year to compensate our staff at a higher rate. So we brought all of the direct care staff members up to a much higher rate to really kind of stop turnover, which is just damaging to the programs and the kids. So in that regard, yes, we have seen some return, but also there's no shortage of ways that the government can figure out how to spend money that they save in one place. So we end up sort of lining up sometimes behind others that want to take advantage of that.
Yeah, Sam, I think a couple of things that you said that are really important. One is just really making sure that we are sharing the incredible results, the return on investment with our partners, with the community, with the media, because that is what's going to, let others know the difference that we're making, the cost savings that we're producing. The other thing you mentioned was your colleagues. I think that's so important, that we reinvest savings, that we reinvest our dollars into our colleagues, because without them, we can't do it. And our sector, unfortunately, underpays people in our sector. And I know you and many of our friends that are involved in these positions want to do better. And one of the things we've been talking about in this podcast is we've been very focused at paying our colleagues commensurate to the value that they provide, the value they provide to the people we serve, the value they provide to our organization, and also the broader society. And I know that resonates with you, and you are doing that as well. So thank you for that. So Sam, I want to get into early intervention and prevention and share that I think today our system is backwards and it's too reactive, right? We have, we wait for someone to have a mental health crisis at 17, 18 years old, and then we try to intervene. Or we wait for someone to penetrate the criminal justice system, and then we try to provide them services. We know that oftentimes it's too late, and it's also too costly. So I'm very interested in this next question about early intervention and prevention. What are you doing in that space?
Well, I think the biggest primary prevention program that we operate isn't often considered a primary prevention program by some people, but it's Head Start. Mm-hmm. So Head Start is a lot more than daycare. It's a comprehensive family support program where there are home visits. You work with the parents. Most often, very common for very young single mothers that were working within the Head Start program, who perhaps have come from, kind of a generational poverty sort of situation. And we work with them, and we help them access services that they need. We provide education on parenting, in addition to then evaluating their children, making sure they have gotten medical care. If they haven't, we'll take them to get it or arrange for them to get it. Dental care. We help parents find jobs. I mean, there's a lot. And we work with non-custodial parents to try to engage them in the kids' lives. So these are programs that are designed to work with the highest risk population, people who are challenged by poverty, by perhaps neighborhoods that aren't particularly safe, and that engaging with them, with those young children and those young families, and providing them with the supports necessary for their children to go to school and be successful, and actually experience success in school. If you think about it, you look at the mega data that they use to determine how many prison beds they're going to need in a state. They look at third grade reading rates. Mm. If kids in third grade can't read in large numbers, they use that calculus to determine how many future prison beds they'll need. And so I'm proud to say that it's not uncommon for the kids to leave our Head Start program and enter kindergarten performing at the second grade level. We test them often. We use evidence-based curriculum. So it's a real strong program to help, avoid the necessity for other interventions later in some cases.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that, Sam. All of those programs that you have are truly impressive and the right thing to do. We got to get to these kids early. And maybe there's an opportunity for us to work together on some of these early intervention programs. We've discussed it in the past, and so maybe there's an opportunity. That'd be great to be working alongside with you.
Anything we can do, Hector, and likewise, we'd love to continue to pick your brain on things that you're doing as well, but there's nothing that we do that's proprietary. We want the system and the process to work better for everybody.
You know, that's what I love about you and other leaders that are involved in our Lutheran Services of America network. We openly share with each other what we're doing because we want other states to have similar or even bigger impact. So that humility that exists amongst the group, I feel so honored and privileged. And by the way, when I first joined LSS, you know, you were one of the names that came up, like, I got to meet Sam. You know, he's doing great things. And the more I get to know you, the more impressed I am with you and with what you're doing in Florida. So thank you for being my friend, and thank you for imparting the wisdom here in this podcast. That completes
Thanks, champ.
Yeah, thank you. That completes round two.
I think you were just lulling me into not panic. Now you're really going to go in with a killer punch, right?
All right. Yes. That completes round two. In round three, Sam will let us know where he and LSF will go from here. Are you ready for the final round?
Yes, sir.
All right. Let's go, champ. Let's discuss a little bit in this round about innovation and strategic partnerships. Recently, you said that it's important to take risk in the social services sector. I think you might have mentioned this at the Leadership Summit. What do you mean by this?
Well, I don't mean that we should take stupid risks, but I do mean that our job is to do things that other people won't do. You know, there's a reason why the very high risk activities and programs that we do with very vulnerable people that with no margin. You know, there's not a lot of others companies lining up to do that kind of work. So I think that if you have a timeless mission, you need to be guided by your mission and not by what you're doing. You know, so if you think about like agencies like ours that got started 150 years ago, they were probably an orphanage, you know, or that was how they served kids and, you know, in a big institutional setting. And if they had continued to look, see themselves as that and only that, they'd be out of business. And some of them are now. But with a more timeless mission where you're focusing on, you want to like use the biblical reference of taking care of widows and orphans. You know, our ministries are all widows and orphans ministries. We're working with kids who don't have the supports that they need from parents, and we're working with elderly people who need support and help. But we're defining it a little differently. You have to continually look for ways that you can take what you do and apply it to the current reality of the world. And I think another way that we take risks that maybe others aren't willing to take is that we don't have shareholders. We don't have SEC filings that we have to do. We don't have to show, profit. Obviously, we have to be able to pay our bills, and we, you know, you've got to have a good bottom line in order to be a sustainable program. But the fact that, you know, we're, I think, in a position where we can take more risks, mm-hmm. where we don't have the same pressures that maybe the for-profit sector might have in terms of, you know, reaching out to people that really need help that were in high risk situations. I think all of what we do, if you think about it, these are all very high risk activities.
Yeah, Sam, you know, that's interesting. I often say that our sector or any organization is not going to reach its full potential unless they're willing to take some risks and be willing to fail. I think our sector, it's hard for us to fail. We have that fear of failure because we have donors, we have colleagues, we have a board of directors, we have stakeholders, we have lots of people that are really relying on us, they're betting on us. And so I often say that our sector is not going to reach its full potential unless we're willing to have some failures along the way. And we can't have some failures along the way unless we are strong from a financial perspective, but also from a governance and leadership perspective. And
I think fast failure is the key, really. Yeah. And I can tell you that we fail at a lot of things that we start. Mm-hmm. We've started many, many things that just didn't work. I'd say at one time I would have said that every 10 ideas that somebody got in our agency resulted in maybe one good program. Mm-hmm. I think now it's probably closer to, out of every 3 good ideas, there's 2 good programs and 1 that doesn't work. A fast failure, like deciding, hey, this didn't work. Don't continue doing it for year after year after year and place a drain on your agency's coffers and the morale of your staff. If you can't be successful at it, then make a quick decision.
Great point, Sam. Next question I have for you is very intriguing, relating to AI. What are you doing in this space? I was just at a Vistas meeting yesterday, and just the technology keeps advancing, the capabilities. It's truly amazing. What are you doing in this space?
Well, so first of all, let me tell you what our staff are doing without really any prompting at this point. But, staff have been using AI, to help write reports, not final drafts, but to help draft reports that are necessary. They're using AI to record meetings and transcribe meeting results. There's a lot of things that people are just doing because they can. It's available now. Here's how we're engaging as an agency with AI right now. We are focusing on 2 things right now. We think that there's so much potential for AI and big data to drive performance of agencies. But instead of focusing on those big things right now, the 2 areas that we want to focus on are some governance standards for how to use AI, mm-hmm. because we don't want to get in trouble. We don't want, what's the confidentiality issues if you're entering client data into an AI bot to draft a report. Stuff like that really hasn't been thought through by some people. So that's one thing. That's kind of nuts and bolts stuff. The other area that we want to focus on are things that will have a demonstrable impact on people's workloads. So we want to take the positions that we have the most difficulty keeping people in, you know, where we have the highest turnover. We want to do some task analyses of what those jobs are, and we want to look for ways that we can use AI to make those jobs more manageable. And that's kind of our first goal. Those are the two areas that we're honing in on right now. We've had staff that have been out attending national AI conferences. We've been identifying a number of experts that we're kind of adding to our consultant list that we want to bring in at the right time to help develop applications or whatever it is that we want to do in terms of making people's jobs more efficient and effective. But that's kind of where we're at right now. But the potential, I mean, it's going to change, I believe. I mean, I'm not the only one saying this, but it's going to change everything. I think it's going to be an equivalent change to the telephone, to the computer, mm-hmm. you know, when those things came, the electric calculator. You know, think about how all those changed everybody's life. This is going to change everybody's life, I think, equally.
Absolutely. As we have AI on our next 3 to 5 year strategic plan, so we'll be learning a lot and we'll be sharing with you and with others. Because if we don't get in this space, we're going to be left behind, and it could really help us be more efficient and effective. So thank you for sharing what you're doing and imparting that wisdom to the rest of us. So now a big, big question and something I think very exciting that you've been working on for some time. I understand that you are now the co-CEO of the Lutheran Collaborative, along with my friend, David Dewey, who I had on the podcast in a previous episode. Can you tell me more what this is about and what you guys are trying to accomplish?
Absolutely. Hector, it actually goes back originally to a meeting that you were at where we were all talking together, different Lutheran executives, about how our agencies were doing pretty well that year, you know, that the numbers had looked good and the outcomes were good. And we were all sort of feeling good about how good our agencies were doing. And then in the breakout sessions, there were all these side conversations about, you know, but our communities really aren't doing good. They're not doing, we may be doing good, but the communities aren't. So what can we do about that? So it's been a process of about 5 years. Conversations with a number of leaders of other Lutheran agencies about, you know, does it really make sense for all of us to reinvent the wheel, you know, about everything that we do, to basically create all of this infrastructure and create all of the knowledge that we get within our agency, but it's really contained in that. Everybody doesn't benefit from it. And a general belief that strong agencies working together are more effective than they are if they work apart from one another. It's difficult to point to an example of this in the for-profit world. I know that so often when we talk about mergers and acquisitions in the nonprofit world, we use the models that the for-profit world use, and it makes sense for them to use those. It doesn't always make sense for us. So each agency maintains its own individual identity, its own board, it has its own CEO. So I'm still the CEO of Lutheran Services Florida. David's still the CEO of Lutheran Community Services Northwest. But now we're under the umbrella of the Lutheran Collaborative. And we've got three, to give you an idea of where this is headed, let me give some practical examples. Mm. We've got three work groups right now that are working teams between our two agencies. The first one's on efficiencies, and they're coming up with some quick deliverables of things that we can do that are kind of no-brainers, like, you know, why don't we use the same purchasing system? Why don't we, you know, are there certain functions that we can do, you know, jointly and not have to have each of us have our own version of it? So that's kind of what the efficiency work group is going to be looking at, is ways where we can realize efficiencies. Then there's a work group on impact. And that is made up of the chief operating officers and their teams, and looking at ways that we can take the best of what we do. What are the things that we do better than Northwest? What are the things they do better than us? How can we learn from each other? How can we take things that each other does? Finally, innovation, which we already sort of touched on, that initiative around AI is our main focus in innovation right now. That's probably more than you wanted, but
sure. No, thank you for sharing all that. And I know that there's a lot more information we could talk about here. I want to end with just one last question here. What are some lessons learned you've developed as a result of this process? I know these things aren't easy. Obviously, you have a great relationship with Dave Dewey that makes it easier. But what are some of those lessons learned you can impart to the rest of us that are on similar journeys to expand partnership?
Well, it's hard. You touched on that already. It's hard, and it will take longer than you think it should. Mm-hmm. So those are two things I've learned.
Yeah.
And then finally, I think, in traditional conversations like this, there are winners and losers. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody's taking over somebody else, or somebody's going to be the big dog versus, you know, the other agency or whatever. What we're trying to create is something really different than that. I mean, there isn't really any takeover here. You know, nobody's taking anybody over. What we're doing is we're trying to figure out a way that we can be stronger together. And that's hard to kind of help people understand that. You know, people tend to want to pigeonhole this into like a merger, like, oh, well, who's going to take who over? Well, nobody's taking anybody over. The two agencies are going to continue to exist, and we'll be inviting other agencies to join us. So I think the idea, you know, it'll take longer than you think it should. It's hard. And chances are, in my experience over the years trying to do other deals like this, unless somebody has to do it, it's real hard. And then when somebody has to do it, you're dealing with an organization that has problems. You know, that's why they have to do it. And what we're trying to do is something different, where we want to attract strong agencies that don't have to do this. But anyway, it's just a very complicated process. And I think the more that we can not apply all of the for-profit business lenses to this venture, because it's not the same thing as a company taking over another company or a company's merging into one company, where you have shareholders and stock and all that. It's just different.
That's the end of round three. But before I let you go, it's time to see how you roll with the punches. I want you to try to answer the following questions with the first thing that comes to your mind. Are you ready?
Yes.
All right, here we go. What's your favorite beach and water sport?
My favorite beach is Caladese Island State Park off the coast of Tampa Bay. And my favorite beach activity or sport is laying in the sun.
Awesome, awesome. And I know you have some nice shorts there, so you wear them well. What is your daily mantra?
I have a different one every day. I get up at 4 o'clock in the morning is my pattern. I get up at 4 and I spend a couple hours looking over my calendar, thinking about what I'm going to do that day and approaching my day with intention. So I have a different mantra every day.
Awesome. What occupation other than your own would you like to try?
Maybe a chef. But only in a place where I would just cook what I want to cook and people would either come and eat it or not. I wouldn't want to work in a chef in a busy restaurant, but that would be fun, I think.
Nice. How did you spend Easter break this year?
Well, I didn't have Easter break. I spent Easter Sunday with my wife and my family. It was just a small family gathering. And since I don't have kids at home, I really don't get Easter break. So,
okay. So last question, what is your game plan for spreading the word about some of the topics we talked about today and some of the challenges facing the social services sector?
Well, I think we just have to continue to talk about it. Like we're doing now, like you do, like I do also, and clarifying for people who we are, what we do, why we do what we do. You know, sometimes people see organizations like LSF or like LSS, and we've got big budgets and lots of staff members, and you know, they don't understand what we are, what we're about. And so I think those are the conversations we just have to keep having, you know, and telling the world why we do what we do, how effective we are at it. And that we're good partners. We're good partners to help solve problems. I think we're positioned in our state as a go-to for problem solving. And that's the result of spreading the word.
Absolutely, Sam. So we're done. You did great. How are you feeling, champ? I don't see no sweat there. Did I work you hard enough?
I have to go. I think I'm going to have to put like a piece of steak on this eye. I don't know.
You look like you can go another two rounds.
Maybe.
Well, thank you so much, Sam. I appreciate you being in the ring with me today. You are such a blessing. You truly were a knockout. Thank you.
Thank you, Hector. Blessings to you as well, my friend.
As always, you can find all of our interviews on our website at lsswis.org/in the ring. Subscribe on YouTube and follow us on Twitter and LinkedIn so you don't miss any important updates and interviews. Thank you to our sponsor, M3 Insurance. Con mucho cariño, with much affection. Bye.